BCG believes that creating climate solutions is the defining challenge of our generation. So we're working with leaders everywhere to understand and mitigate the cost of climate inaction. But we're also helping them find ways to innovate, build sustainable businesses, and stay competitive in an evolving world. Stick around to discover the many opportunities in a more sustainable global economy.
Welcome to Zero. I'm Akshat Rathi. This week, wind industry struggles and victories. If you've heard anything about the wind industry in recent years, it's mostly bad news. Building projects is becoming more expensive, getting government permission to build wind farms is taking much longer, and big companies like Ørsted, Vestas, and Siemens are struggling. But it's not all bad news. There are still big players winning at the wind game. One of them is Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners. It's not as famous as other companies, but it's a big player. Since 2012, CIP has raised $28 billion, and it now has 150 gigawatts of clean energy projects in the pipeline. That's roughly the size of the UK's electricity generation capacity, under one company. CIP is so big, in fact, that the company is now even talking about building artificial islands out in the sea to further speed up the deployment of offshore wind power. To understand how CIP is managing to navigate the challenges of the wind industry, I spoke to one of its founders, Jakob Baruel Poulsen. He got his start building offshore wind projects in what used to be Danish Oil and Natural Gas and is now Ørsted. You can hear more of that story in a previous episode of Zero with Ørsted CEO Mads Nipper. Jakob benefited from the initial wave of government subsidies given to offshore wind projects by countries like the UK and Denmark. And then he used that success to create CIP and bring in big investors such as pension funds and insurance companies to build even bigger offshore wind projects. I spoke to Jakob at the World Economic Forum meeting this year in Davos to understand how the wind industry is dealing with the many challenges it faces, why CIP has been so profitable, and what will be needed to keep deploying offshore wind to meet climate goals. Jakob, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
CIP was founded in 2012, but before that, you worked for Dong Energy for a decade or more. That company is now called Ørsted and is a giant in the offshore wind industry. So could you talk me through that period of working for Dong Energy and what made you leave Dong Energy to create CIP?
Well, I started already in 2001, actually, and my first job was to consolidate six Danish energy companies into what became Dong Energy and what is now Ørsted. And a few years after we did that six-way merger, I became head of offshore wind in Ørsted and in 2007 and grew the company or the offshore wind division from around 50 people to around 1,500 people. So that was a really, really interesting experience for me. And when I left in 2012, quite a few of those people I had worked with in the offshore wind division followed me to the CIP company and are still there. So we have been working together for almost 20 years, many of us.
But let's be honest, you were known as the golden birds in Dong Energy. You were building these offshore wind projects and making a ton of money for the company, but also for yourself. And Denmark, you know, the state prefers that the executives of its state-owned companies did not personally profit so much. And so was having CIP as an independent company just allow you to grab opportunities that you could not have at Dong Energy, which of course became Ørsted?
I think the reason why we established CIP was that we wanted to give access to many, many more investors than just the Danish state into the offshore wind space. So we saw that offshore wind would not only be a Danish or a North Sea phenomenon, but it would be potentially become a global thing, which it has subsequently. We wanted to give access to many investors. So today we have 200 institutional investors in CIP who are investing into our offshore projects across Europe, Asia, and the US.
And since 2012, when you created CIP, you've gone on to raise $28 billion, which makes you one of the largest spenders on clean energy in the world. But you don't just raise money and invest in projects. CIP actually goes out and builds energy projects. Could you talk me through the idea of having CIP as the body that raises money and then working with Copenhagen Offshore Partners? That's the body that goes out and builds these projects.
Yes, we see ourselves as a hybrid between a financial company and an energy company. So we try to take the best from both worlds. We have a very, very strong financial muscle because of our fund structure, etc. So we can always attract money on an ongoing basis, on a very flexible basis, in a way that suits our investors very well. But on the other hand, we have around 2,000 people working in our system, doing project development all over the world, 24/7, in 30-something countries. So I think it's a very good combination. So it's a hybrid model between a fund setup and an energy company setup. And I think it's quite unique, actually. But it works very, very well.
But on Copenhagen Offshore Partners, the body that builds these projects, you're not involved in the management of that company. So when you say it's a hybrid structure, what exactly is the connection between CIP and COP?
So Copenhagen Offshore Partners, a service company, which is owned by some of our former colleagues from Ørsted, who established an engineering company, if you will, who are then servicing our projects across the world. And we have a number of other similar companies who are servicing us in different fields. And we work on an exclusive basis with all these companies and have a very long-term relationship with most of these people we've worked with for 15 or 20 years.
And in building so many projects and raising billions of dollars, could you just talk us through some of the biggest projects that you've worked on since 2012? What are the challenges that you faced as you tried to build this industry? Because when you started, yes, offshore wind was something that was starting to scale, but it was still very early days. It was expensive. It required subsidies and support from government to become commercial. Even now, there are subsidies around the world for offshore, and so it's not quite price competitive. Of course, it's become much cheaper in recent years. So yeah, talk us through the projects and the challenges.
No, you're absolutely right. So 15, 20 years ago, offshore wind was a heavily subsidized sector. And nowadays, it's in most countries, it's actually a sector which can compete with other energy sources on a grand scale. So in Europe, there are not really any subsidies anymore. It's actually the energy sector pays money to governments for the right to build offshore winds. In other countries, it's a little bit different, but it has been a very, very interesting development. And I think something that we will see continue in the future, it's offshore wind is unique in the sense that there's actually no limit for how big you can do the projects. So that's where it differs quite a bit from onshore wind, where there are some natural physical limitations usually for how big you can do the projects.
And some projects that you've built and what challenges you faced?
Our daily life is to face challenges, physical challenges, regulatory challenges. So we've had hundreds, if not thousands of challenges in all our projects. So I think that the two projects I'm mostly proud of recently is our Wynyard wind project in the US, which will be the first. It's almost being finished now, and it will be the first commercial scale offshore wind project in North America. And I'm also very proud about our Changfang Sidao project in Taiwan, which is the first offshore wind project in Asia outside of mainland China. So these two, I think, are on a global scale, actually landmark projects. We have had issues in both cases, but the projects has ended up being built on time and on budget.
And what kind of challenges did you face as you were trying to build these first of a kind for those regions, at least, projects?
So there have been project-specific challenges, for instance, in Taiwan, which is, you know, very, very far away from the European supply chain. So a lot of stuff we've had to export that to Taiwan. We've had to build an industry in Taiwan to build the foundations and things like that. We've had to have many, many discussions with government about the regulatory framework for offshore wind in Taiwan, etc. So it has been a very, very long journey over the past 6 or 7 years since we started back in 2015 or 16.
And same thing, I assume, in the US, which is only just really getting into the offshore wind game. And already many of the developers are either walking back or having to take billion-dollar write-downs.
Exactly. So I personally started going to the US 12 years ago, looking for offshore possibilities. And the first project we attempted to do never happened, actually. That was the Cape Wind project. That was ultimately abandoned before it was even started. So it has been a long journey also in the US.
And one of the challenges that you face is regulatory certainty. I mean, in the US, even if there is incentive to build, subsidy to build, regulatory challenges such as permitting or governments deciding, yes, it's okay to build, and then suddenly deciding, no, no, there are challenges there. Whales might be affected, as some tried to say. So how do you deal with that?
We try to have some serious conversations with the relevant regulatory bodies before we even consider building. So in the early stage, in the development phase, and really try to map out any possible issues there could be. And I think it actually generally works quite well in most cases. I think there's some good methodology now in the industry for identifying, for instance, environmental issues such as the whale issue in North America. And there are now also a set that is a good toolbox for dealing with the issue so that we don't disturb the whales in critical periods, etc. So I think all in all, we see that the amount of issues are going down because the industry is simply becoming more and more experienced. On the other hand, of course, a new set of issues have arisen in the supply chain because of the big volumes and the congestions in the supply chain. And so there's always something we need to look after. And lately it has been a lot supply chain related, what we have been focusing on.
Well, I mean, let's get specific there, because one thing that's happened because of the supply chain issues is that prices of offshore wind have gone up. Mm. And as prices have gone up, some of the governments have decided not to go ahead with an auction or not to build a project. And then companies have had to do write-downs. The overall profitability of this industry is under question. You're seeing not just companies like Ørsted or Vestas or Siemens Energy face challenges, but also oil companies, which were thinking about becoming big players in the offshore space, are taking a step back and they're questioning whether it's an industry we should enter. So given your exposure to offshore wind and given your history of building these projects, how do you think the industry can overcome this real big challenge? Because it's clear we need a lot more wind power in the world.
I'm actually not so concerned about it. I've been in offshore wind for more than 20 years now, and we've seen this happening a couple of times before. For instance, around the financial crisis, we had a similar situation as what we see now. So I think it will work out. We have seen recently that some of the PPA prices have increased again.
PPA stands for Power Purchasing Agreement, and it's a contract a company that consumes electricity signs with another company producing electricity. The key detail in the contract is what fixed price that renewable energy will be sold for how long.
So, for instance, the latest U.S. allocation of PPAs were at a higher price level than previously. We have seen also in Ireland, for instance, that the prices have increased. And the U.K. government also has told me that they are considering a new auction instead of the failed one, etc. So I think the industry will move on. So I don't see this as a fundamental issue in the industry. It is a natural reaction to the cost increases. We should remember that offshore wind is still a relatively cheap energy resource in most areas compared to fossil fuel-based electricity production.
So do you think the era of falling costs for offshore wind is over?
A period of time where there will be an adjustment, so the cost level will need to, the revenue level will need to adjust so it can cover the costs. But I'm confident it will be way cheaper than fossil fuel based. And then I'm sure as we see new technological progress sort of happen, we will in the long run see a continued downwards trend again.
Right. So you expect that you're going to see price declines happening soon. But of course, right now we are in that environment of price increases. When do you start seeing the trend reverse to what used to be?
It's very, very hard to say because it's a combination of technological aspects and some macroeconomic energy market aspects. So oil prices, gas prices, and things like that. So it's hard for me to come with a firm estimate here, but I clearly see that we have a short run adjustment so that revenues and cost align. And then we have a longer run fundamental decrease in the cost of renewable energy.
Now, one model that companies building clean energy projects use is to build a project, then sell off a portion of that project or to sell off the entire project to infrastructure investors, bigger holders of capital. That way, they don't hold as much debt on their books and can use that capital to go and build more projects. Does CIP use the same model?
Our key value creation process is to develop and construct renewable energy projects. And then we actually seek a good long-term buyer for the projects. And in some cases, we sell 100% of the equity. And in other cases, we sell, for instance, 49%. And that depends a little bit on the buyer preferences. So it's a little bit decided from case to case.
And when you go out and raise funds, which you do and have done so much of, what different types of funds do you create to be able to attract these large investors? And just talk us through what type of investor is interested in what type of fund.
So we create funds which are regulated by the Danish FSA. So it's a regulated financial product we are doing. And it's relevant primarily for big institutional investors, so primarily pension funds, and it can also be family offices and insurance companies and other financial investors. Even the nuclear industry has actually invested money in our funds, which I'm very proud of. So it's really relevant for people who want to invest capital for 10, 15 years and who has a positive view on the renewable energy transition and who believes in our ability to develop and construct projects.
We'll be back with more from the conversation after the break.
Today's leaders face many hard choices, confronted with uncertainty, cost pressures, and growing shareholder demands, but they don't have to choose between pursuing climate and business goals. In fact, BCG research suggests that these ambitions go hand in hand. Did you know at least 40% of executives at large organizations estimate an annual financial benefit of $100 million for meeting emissions reduction targets, according to recent BCG research? BCG also found that transitioning to the circular economy could help unlock $4.5 trillion of GDP growth by 2030. The cost of inaction, however, is profound. In fact, further analysis indicates that missing climate targets could result in an average annual EBITDA reduction of 15%. At BCG, our experts recognize the myriad benefits, from risk mitigation to first mover advantage, that come with sustainability. Let's partner to unlock a better sustainability journey.
And are there some of your backers that you can talk about? Because I think you started with one investor and now you said you have 200. Who have been the consistent ones?
We have our biggest investor is still Pension Denmark, who sort of invested in our first fund. They are still our biggest investor. We have, I would say, most of the Danish pension funds. And in Denmark, we are very blessed to have a very, very strong pension sector where all Danes are forced to invest into the pension funds, basically. And we have many German clients, many Scandinavian clients, quite a few Asian investors also, including several sovereign wealth funds also. We are still quite small in terms of U.S. investors, but that's growing. And the U.S. is the biggest capital market in the world, so it's a big priority for us to get more exposure to U.S. clients.
Now, the oil industry is famous for its boom and bust cycle. oil prices rise, more people invest in trying to supply oil. That causes too much supply, and then oil prices fall. Then demand starts to rise, oil prices rise again, and the cycle just repeats. Is clean energy also becoming a victim of the boom and bust cycle?
I think we see an element of that also. I think what is quite clear in the renewable energy sector is that quite a few of the investors who want to invest into renewable energy are only allowed formally or implicitly to invest into brownfield assets. So essentially assets that has been brought into operation. It's basically investors who cannot take development and construction risks. So when we see these boom and bust cycles, it's primarily because a lot of money are chasing a scarce number of brownfield assets, and the prices are then increased a lot, and then returns fall for those investors.
And brownfield being already existing
assets.
Already
existing assets, exactly. So the point I'm making here is that the investment starting returns for brownfield investments can be a little bit volatile. But for greenfield assets, it's actually remarkably stable in the 25 years I've been in this business.
And greenfield investments is where you actually go and build these things. And what's the rough stable return that you've seen in that?
Then I would say it has been around 10%. That has been the return level we have seen for greenfield returns over many years. Of course, it's going up and down a little bit, but it has much less to do with financial markets and speculation. It has much more to do with technological progress, power prices sometimes also. But it has been remarkably stable. And the way we work in CIP is that we have a very, very big portfolio of investment opportunities. So we're developing around 150 gigawatt of renewable energy projects. So that's comparable to all of Germany's renewable energy. So a massive portfolio. And it means that we always have some projects which are mature, where we can take the decision to invest. And we also have the opportunity to say, okay, this project is not attractive right now. Let's defer it a little bit and then focus on other projects. And that gives us quite a bit of stability, because we can always just focus on the best projects and let the other projects develop until they become as good as we want them to be.
And if you didn't want to do just one number, what other numbers would you talk about?
We are usually investing at around 10%, and we very often sell in the brownfield space at a return level of maybe 6% or something like that. So there's a quite good value pickup from the activity we do, and that's the key attraction for the investors in CIP, that we can underwrite projects usually at around 10%, and we can usually sell them when they have been constructed and we have taken the risks, usually at around 6%.
And so if we talk about it in sort of a billion-dollar valuation, say you build a project that's worth $1 billion, when you sell it to a large investor, how much are you charging them?
Then it can sometimes happen that we charge them $2 billion.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good rate of return.
Yeah, but we take some risks and some, you know, there are some costs also. And it's not just a free lunch, right? We actually do quite a bit of work for that over several years. Sometimes it's also less than $2 billion, right? It can also be 1.5 or something, but it has never happened. It's less than one. Let me say it like this. So.
And if we are in a bust cycle right now, given the state of the wind industry, how do you take advantage as an investor with plenty of cash to spend?
No, but we have had a period now where we have bought, acquired, developed quite a number of development projects. So we have expanded our development portfolio. So I think over the past 2 or 3 years, we have probably expanded the development portfolio from around 90 to 100 gigawatts to around 150 gigawatts. So you could say that our inventory or our wine cellar, so to speak, has grown. I think there could be a good possibility that we see into now a boom cycle, and then we will sell out a little bit and the wine cellar will diminish a little bit again. That would be my expectation.
And you've built a lot of offshore wind projects. What are some of the exciting innovations that you've seen over the years beyond just the fact that the more you deploy, the cheaper it is to build these turbines out in the sea?
No, but I think the exciting things are actually all the unexciting things. So it's a number of quite technical and quite boring things. So there's not one big fancy moonshot thing that has changed the whole world here. It has been a number of smaller things.
But recently you've created a new company that's going to build energy islands offshore. Now, that sounds like a James Bond movie set. What is it really?
Yeah, that was not the plan to do James Bond movies. We actually see this idea about building artificial islands in the North Sea and certain places in Asia also as a natural prolongation of the development of offshore wind in the last 30 years. So 35 years ago, the first project was built in Denmark. That was 5 megawatt. Then a few years after, 100 megawatt project was built. And now most of the projects we are doing are 1,000 megawatt projects. We hope that 7 to 10 years from now, it will be 10,000 megawatt projects. And there we need islands for the electrical infrastructure, for power to X, for the service facilities, et cetera, et cetera. So we see it actually as prolonging the exponential growth we have seen over the last 35 years. Whether James Bond movies will be done on the islands also, I cannot say. But so most of the stuff that will take place there will be pretty boring, right? That will be, you know, electrical engineers who will run around and make sure that the wind turbines are connected properly. So, yeah.
Well, that could be an extra source of revenue if you can sell it to a James Bond movie. But just to understand the concept, right now you have these offshore wind turbines that are typically anchored to the seafloor. There's a big base that is built on top of which there's a big pole. And then you have these turbines, which can be sometimes as big as the Eiffel Tower, just out in the sea. Of course, then you have to take a big, long cable. And perhaps you bring many of those turbines into one cable at a substation. And then you have to take another long cable back out to the land where this electricity is consumed. So all you're saying now is as this industry grows and you have many, many more wind turbines than there are out there, instead of having so many cables going out directly to land, you create a hub where those cables come in. And then from that hub, you still have to take a cable back to
ground? Yeah, but the whole point here is that wind power is an intermittent resource. So around half of the time the wind is blowing, the other half it's blowing less. So it means that if we do an energy island, as we call it, and we connect all the wind turbines to the island and they send the power to the island, then we only need a smaller cable from the island to shore than we would otherwise have needed. But that cable will then be full all of the time instead of only being full half of the time. So that's the purpose of the island, is to facilitate energy storage, power to X facilities, so that when we have surplus power, it will be exported in a pipeline as hydrogen to shore. And exporting energy in a pipeline is only cost a small fraction of what it costs to export it in a power cable. So the big driver for the island thinking is that it is very, very expensive to build all these electricity cables. So we try to save a lot of billions and billions of euros on that. And we also, by doing that, we create a more stable, almost a flat production profile for power. So the power cable that we do build is then almost 100% utilized.
But if the power cable is 100% utilized, that's good, because then you're going to get a higher rate of return on that power cable, except the hydrogen electrolyzers that you will install will not be running at 100% power. And so they will be half utilized. And so they won't have the kind of return. And so how do you balance? Because, of course, yes, cables are expensive, but they're also kind of simple, right? They're made of copper, and electrolyzers much more complicated. You need more precious metals. And of course, the price of green hydrogen hasn't quite come down.
Yeah.
So you want to use those electrolyzers 100% of the time.
Yeah, but our calculation shows that there's a very clear economic benefit from having more electrolyzers and less cable. And there will also be an element, most likely, of battery storage on the island also, to some extent. in order to fully stabilize the export of power.
And just so we have numbers on how much money this saves, make a case for how big a project and how much money would be saved.
Let's say one island, one island would probably anchor around 10 gigawatts of wind power. So the total capex of that would be around 30 billions or more. Only maybe 1 or 2 billions will be the island itself. So that's actually a quite small investment. Many people think an artificial island is expensive, but that it's actually relatively cheap. That transmission investments will probably be 5 or 7 billion euros lower than they would otherwise have been.
You're right. I mean, it doesn't have to be that expensive to build artificial islands. Of course, Dubai has built entire maps and different designs with artificial islands just off the coast of Dubai. So it's not that expensive. But, you know, just looking at it from a technology perspective, from a risk perspective, there are two big things that this creates. One, the benefit of renewables is that they are decentralized. And if you attack a nuclear power plant, that could be a big danger. But if you attack a wind farm, you know, the damage isn't that much. Now you create a central hub where all this power comes in, just becomes a very easy target from a geopolitics perspective. How are you going to tackle the challenges that brings?
As a starting point, renewable energy is improving Europe's security of supply situation. If you think about offshore projects, it's a little bit similar to the existing oil and gas projects we have in the North Sea. I don't think the energy island will be more vulnerable for an attack compared to a gas installation, for instance. So we have that vulnerability already. I think we will, of course, when we suggest islands, we will, of course, have a debate with the various governments about how can we improve the security for those installations from the start. So I'm sure there will be various technologies available for that, for surveillance and protection.
You will also have to manage sea level rise, building an artificial island in
Absolutely.
A world that's warming.
We have for many years taken that into account when we built the offshore wind projects, that there was an expectation for sea level rise.
And then you'll have to, of course, contend with the difficult guessing game that everybody is in right now, which is whether the hydrogen demand will appear or not, because the way you make your economics of this energy island work is that you have this hydrogen production and that is piped back to the ground. And, you know, for all the interest in hydrogen, and yes, there are applications for it in many places, and there's also lots of subsidies that governments want to give, it hasn't actually ended up being used at scale in many, many places.
I think what is important in relation to hydrogen in a European context is that I don't think many people in Europe would doubt that we need electricity 10, 20, 30, or 50 years from now. I think most people would agree with that. And we see very, very high electricity prices right now. And the main product from the islands and from all offshore wind parks, that will be the electricity produced. So the hydrogen will be a byproduct. And it means also that most of the revenues for these projects will come from the electricity side, and it actually means that the necessary price we need for the hydrogen will be relatively low. So it will be relatively competitive also with other sources of hydrogen because it's a byproduct. So we don't need that much money. We will earn most of the money, or the projects will earn most of their money on the electricity side.
So the company is called Copenhagen Energy Islands, and your plan is to spend something like 150 billion euros over the next decades to be able to build multiple of these islands. I do hope there is a James Bond movie set on one of these islands if it does get built. Thank you, Jakob.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Zero. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate or review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share this episode with a friend or with someone who likes being out at sea. You can get in touch at zeropod@bloomberg.net. Zero's producers are Tiffany Choi, Magnus Henriksen, and Somer Sadi. Our theme music is composed by Wonderly. Special thanks to Kira Bindrim and Will Mathis. I'm Akshat Rathi. Until next time.